The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Catherine Pompilio with an episode from the Lawfare Archive for February 19th, 2022. Tensions in Eastern Europe are quickly rising as the U.S. and Western allies continue their diplomatic push to prevent a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russia has amassed over 150,000 troops along the Ukrainian border, and just this week allegedly launched a cyber attack on Ukrainian military, energy, and other critical computer networks. The cyber attack could potentially be utilized to support Russian military operations or even to create panic amongst the Ukrainian people and government to destabilize the country. For today's archive episode, I picked an episode from November 2017 in which Brookings fellow Alina Polyakova spoke with Andrei Soldatov about Russian intelligence operations and surveillance. They also discussed Russia's perspective on the 2016 election meddling, Edward Snowden, and much more.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 11th, 2017. That's the voice of Russian independent journalist Andrei Soldatov, an expert on Russian intelligence operations and surveillance. Soldatov is the author of The New Nobility and The Red Web, two books on the Russian intelligence apparatus. My new colleague, Alina Polyakova, interviewed him in my office last week. They covered a lot of ground. It's everything you need to know about the Russian side of the 2016 elections, but we're afraid to ask. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 260, Andrei Soldatov on Russian Intel Ops and Surveillance. So, podcast listeners, this week, our interview is not going to be conducted by me, and it's not a Brookings event. We are joined this week by special guest host Alina Polyakova, my new colleague in the foreign policy program at Brookings. Alina, welcome to the Lawfare podcast, and you've taken it over in a bloodless coup.
Thanks, Ben.
So this is the first in what we hope will be a bunch of podcasts that Alina is going to do on matters Russia. We figured that there is just a great deal of ignorance about what has become a major adversarial power over the last few years. And so, Alina, tell us a little bit about the project that you're going to be doing.
So thanks, Ben, for letting me co-op the podcast a couple of times over the next couple of months. Well, I think most listeners of Lawfare have been following the ongoing Russian investigation in the United States, Russian interference in our own elections, and what that all means, not just for the United States, but for the West as we know it. But what we don't know much about is how are the Russians really doing this? How are they looking at the West? What do they think about all this? And on the other hand, what's really happening in Russian society? I think some people see Russia as this monolith that's 10 feet tall, but it's not. And that's what we're trying to get to the bottom of here.
So lots of Lawfare podcast listeners right now are saying, yeah, but who the heck is Alina Polyakova? So why don't you answer that question for them? How did you get into this and who the heck are you?
So I'm a new fellow here at Brookings in the Foreign Policy Program. as you may guess from my name, I'm from that part of the world, originally from Ukraine. Have been working on trying to understand how the Russians run influence operations in Europe for a number of years. And I thought it was just about time now that the U.S. has been the latest victim of Russian attacks for us to learn more about how the Russians do what they do.
And tell us a little bit more about your guest.
So Andrei Soldatov is a very well-known independent Russian journalist. And as many people might know, it's not very easy to be an independent Russian journalist in Russia today. He and his co-author, Irina Baragan, who didn't join us on the podcast, but is a co-author on all his work, have started a sort of watchdog independent website to try to understand what has been happening in the consolidation of Russian intelligence services, and also how the Russian state has not just cracked down political opposition, but has really increased its surveillance operation in society.
All right. And with that, here is the actual podcast.
So Andrei, I think many of our listeners probably don't know much about you. You come to us from Moscow. We know that much. But tell us a bit more about, what's your story? What's your background? You're a Russian journalist, working on surveillance issues for a long time. What is that like to be working on these issues in Russia today? How did you get into this line of business in the first place?
It's a tricky story, especially today. But actually, I started in the 1990s, in the late 1990s, and actually my first topic was information technologies, but I became very bored with this stuff very quickly in 2 years. But sometimes it's really crazy to fly to Texas, for example, to be shown into some room and to be present at some presentation of a new printer or Xerox machine, and then to fly back. So I wanted to do something more exciting, and I thought that to write about the Russian security services would be interesting, especially because in the late 1990s, we got this new war in Chechnya, we got Vladimir Putin as Russian Prime Minister, so it was quite clear that security services would be a big topic. And it is. It's still a big topic. But we needed to find, me and my colleague Irina Baragan, we needed to find a way how to report about these things. Especially, it's quite tricky because you need to have some connections or probably some sort of background, and we didn't have this kind of things. So we wanted to invent something, maybe technical, and we came up with the idea of launching a special website which could be seen as a kind of watchdog of Russian security services. But for that, we needed an inspiration. So we found this inspiration in Federation of American Scientists secrecy project run by Steve Aftergood. It's an amazing project, actually. It's a great example of making the security services transparent. So we established our website, agentura.ru, and we've been writing together for this website and for many Russian independent newspapers for many years. But the problem is that in Russia, after 2000, always something happened to your publication. Well, editor could be fired, newspaper could be closed down. So together we changed 6 or 7 publications in only in 2000s.
You had to switch jobs so many times,
yes,
as journalists?
Yes, because always something happened to these publications. And finally, by the end of 2000s, we understood that there was no room for this kind of thing to do in Russia, in Moscow, and we were quite desperate what we can do. But an American journalist, a friend of ours, suggested an absolutely crazy idea to try to write a book about Russian security services for an American publisher. I never tried this before. I never written anything in English, and I thought, wow, it's absolutely crazy, but because when you are really desperate, you can do whatever it could. You can, and we finally supplied a proposal, and thanks to some friends, Eventually, it ended up on the table of an editor of public affairs, Peter Osnes, and he said, "Fine, let's try." So that's why that was the way we got our first book, The New Nobility, published in 2010.
Yeah, so I should mention, since you're bringing it up, you know, one, I think your background being a journalist, focusing on the specific issue of Russian security services is really unique. You said, how can we bring more transparency to the security services, to surveillance? You know, if we know anything about Russian surveillance services or security services, is that they're anything but transparent. So I know you don't have an easy job. You know, you're about to start talking about your second book, but I thought I would introduce it instead and do it for you. So you published The Red Web, and you just came out with the second edition of it. It's a really excellent book. I highly recommend it. The Red Web, The Kremlin's War on the Internet, by Andrei Soldatov and Irina Baragan. It's available on Amazon. I think this is a really key moment for Americans to understand how Russian surveillance services actually work. What I found really fascinating about the book, and you started talking about this already, is you describe the emergence of Russia's surveillance state all the way from the Cold War, the beginnings of the Cold War, to the current moment. Can you talk a little bit about how Russia became what you consider a surveillance state, and if you agree that it is, in fact, a surveillance state today?
Unfortunately, it is. And to be honest, when we started researching for the book, we were very surprised to find that many things, many technologies and methods we can trace back to the Soviet Union. And actually, our book started in 1947, long before the internet was actually developed by in the United States. Why? Well, for some reasons. And one of the reasons is that some ideas how to surveil, how to spy on people, how to use surveillance against people as a tool of intimidation, as a kind of warning for people to stay quiet, and actually as a way to control people. Well, it was invented and designed many years ago, back in the Soviet times. And even the Russian system of online surveillance was the idea, the concept of this system, which is known as the SOAR, which stands for System of Operative Search Measures, was invented and developed in the late 80s by the KGB. And the KGB, in turn, was inspired by the example of Stasi. We wanted to imitate the Stasi approach.
The German East German security service,
mm-hmm. famous for being able to intercept almost everything in East Germany. And they had much more advanced system of surveillance. So the KGB wanted to imitate this approach to make it much more systematic. And they came up with this idea of essentially of backdoors, mirroring all kind of traffics to the KGB. Well, for some reasons, obvious reasons, the Soviet Union collapsed. This project was delayed and was actually introduced in Russia only in the mid-1990s, late 1990s. But the problem is that this system has been, well, developed ever since, and actually we got the new development, the new update, actually this year. So it's a very new system in terms of technology, but in terms of design, it's still Soviet. It's essentially Soviet, a very intrusive system.
How exactly does SORM work?
The idea of SORM is actually very simple. You have telecommunication companies, you have internet service providers in Russia, thousands of them. Every one of them is required by Russian legislation to install a small black box, which would be connected to the local branch of the FSB. The idea of this black box is to provide access, completely unrestricted access for the FSB. And the problem is that in many cases, It means that a telecommunication person, telecommunication company personnel, just install this black box, close the door, seal this door, and have no access to this room with this black box. The idea is that you just provide this access for the FSB, and then you know nothing about what kind of information is intercepted by the FSB.
So you're telling me that in Russia today, any company, whether they be a Russian company or a foreign company that has operations within Russia, is required by law to basically provide access to the Russian security services, the FSB, to whatever information is being transferred on their servers or on their telecommunication networks.
Correct.
That's fascinating. You know, to what extent have Western companies that have operations in Russia been complying with this legislation?
The crucial question here is where you have your servers. That's why we have a special legislation, so-called data localization law, which means that the Russian government tries to force global platforms like Twitter, Google, or Facebook to move their servers to Russia. Because to install these black boxes, actually backdoors, you need to have access to servers. It's not enough to have access to cables. You need to have access to servers because it's the way we have encryption these days. In many companies, you can have so-called end-to-end encryption, which means that it's impractical to intercept a message on the in a cable. You need to have access to servers, and biggest international companies, they are required by the Russian law to move their servers, but they didn't do that. And so it's a game we are seeing now. We have this legislation in force since 2015, but it looks like global platforms are still very hesitant and they do not want to move their servers to Russia.
So, you know, does Google have their servers in Russia? What about Facebook, Twitter, all of these social media companies that we're not paying a lot of attention to here in the United States? Have they complied with this legislation as far as you know?
As far as we know, because these companies are extremely secretive, they do not comply with this law. Google have some servers, but it's not these servers are not about personal data, not about content. It's basically their cache servers for Google. So it's about results of your searches and not about your personal information or content of your emails. Facebook and Twitter, they are in a better position than Google because out of these three companies, only Google has the Moscow office. So Facebook and it's quite difficult to put Facebook and Twitter under pressure. But the Russian government tries best, and they routinely issue some warnings that say Facebook would be blocked in 2018 with some threats to Twitter. So it happens every day almost. Mm-hmm. But so far it looks like there is no political, say, decision to block these servers, services in Russia.
So information, at least on these particular companies, is still not within the hands of the FSB?
Yes,
as far as we know.
We hope so.
I think what's fascinating about what you're describing and also what you and Irina talk about in your book, Red Web, is this almost obsession that the Russian state has today and then the Soviet Union has had before the Russian state during the Cold War with control of information. And that in many ways what we see happening now with this crackdown on media freedoms for users, this desire to force international companies to allow the Russian security services access to their information through the surveillance system, that this is really part of a very, very long history in Russia, this obsession with controlling information. You know, why is that? How do you understand, you know, how the Kremlin today, broadly defined, let's say the Kremlin, the power in the Kremlin, how they think about information? Why is this such a threat?
Well, for Well, you're absolutely right. It started many years ago, I would say maybe in the 20s, maybe even before the revolution. It's coming from Lenin's idea about the role of the media. When he described the role of newspapers, he said that their main role is to mobilize masses. And so for him, newspapers was not something about the information, it was something about mobilizing people. And of course, that's why for him it was absolutely logical to censor and to block and to to shut down all, say, liberal or bourgeois media in Soviet Russia. And this thought was absolutely, well, Stalin actually repeated the same thing in 1930s. This idea was very, I would say, integral to the Soviet Union. And to be honest, if we are thinking about the mindset of KGB people, what happened in the 1990s completely proved their point. They got the war in Chechnya in the mid of 1990s. And for people in the security services and for people in the Kremlin, the only reason we lost, we believe, was because we had unrestricted access to Chechnya for Russian and foreign journalists. So when Putin came to power in 1999, and that was the moment when we got the second Chechen war, the way this war was sold to the Russian people was that we lost the first war because of journalists. So we need to do something to protect our information space. That's why very early, actually in 2000, we got the very first Russian doctrine of information security. And if you read this fascinating document, you can find that they stipulate that foreign media could pose a threat. And that's why, actually since 2000, we have all these talks in the Kremlin and in the security services that we need to control information. That's why we had always this big conflict with, say, between the Russian cybersecurity community and the Western cybersecurity community. The Western cybersecurity communities have been always insisting on speaking in terms of cybersecurity or cyber warfare. Mm-hmm. The Russians have insisted talking about information security, meaning the content. Mm-hmm. They always want to control the content because they believe it is much more important than, say, cables or computers. And unfortunately now, lots of people even here started, say, accepting this point of view or even this language, but we need to do something with the content.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, They informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
So I think just taking back a step for a moment, you know, you describe all of these surveillance services that have emerged in Russia today, this desire to control the information space, particularly since Putin came to power. But, you know, if we're trying to kind of get in the head of Putin himself or people close to him, people in power in Russia today, how do they think about intelligence operations more broadly? Because I think what we observe as outsiders in the United States, so it seems that under Putin, the Russian state and the Russian security services have basically become one and the same, that the security apparatus in Russia has penetrated all parts of politics and the political institutions, and there's very little separation. Of course, as you said, when Putin came to power, you knew the surveillance and security was going to be a big issue because Putin was, before that, the head of the FSB and had a long career in the FSB as a young man and until he basically became the head of state in Russia. But where does, you know, what's the bigger picture here? How does the Russian state today under Putin think about intelligence services, intelligence operations? Where does domestic surveillance fit into all of this?
Well, the problem here is that Putin, he loves to present himself as a direct successor to Andropov, and meaning that Andropov was a long-standing chief of the KGB, and then he was promoted to be head of the state. But basically,
and that was before Yeltsin?
Yes, it was actually in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. The thing is that actually it's not true, because Andropov was not a trained KGB guy. He was not a trained KGB officer. He was a political appointee. He was actually an official at the Communist Party sent by the political party, by the Communist Party, to oversee the KGB. He became a director of the KGB, but essentially by his training, he was a political guy. But with Putin, very first time in our history, we have a guy who is a trained security agent, and he is the head of the state, which means that when he speak to his security services, there is no gap, there is no distance at all. They share the same mentality, the same prejudices, the same background. They speak the same language. They speak in the language of threats. And actually, if you look at the way Putin speaks about sensitive things, like, for example, the development of the internet, he sees the internet in terms of threats. First of all, he talks about everything in terms of threats. And it's a very, it's a KGB mentality. That's one thing. The second thing is we have an essential problem of Russian bureaucracy. If you have a new head of state, for him, it's always difficult and tricky to find his way to find new people to give them prominent positions. And it was a problem for Yeltsin. He solved this problem, using regional approach. He just brought to Moscow lots of people from his town, Yekaterinburg. Putin did the same. He brought to Moscow lots of people from St. Petersburg, but he also believed that he could trust only people from the security services. And he made them, in a way, the new Russian aristocracy. That's why the chief of the FSB back then, Nikolai Patrushev, coined this term, the new nobility. He actually used this term to name his own people.
And that's, of course, the title of your first book.
Yes, that's why it was not chosen by us. I mean, that term was coined by Nikolai Patrushev. And, of course, when you have a head of the state who could rely, or he believes he could rely, only on people from the security services, they bring to the government a very special mentality. And this mentality is suspicious by definition. And very early, already in the early 2000s, we understood that this, because we are journalists, so we are outsiders. So we need to talk to people inside. And it was very clear from the beginning that Putin wanted to change this. He started raising defenses around the government, around the parliament. His idea was, he made the government apparatus very suspicious of any kind of questions and of any kind of outside expertise. He got rid of external expertise in the parliament, for example. And we got this very interesting thing. So if you ask a question, the immediate reaction of Putin and his people to ask you back why you are asking this question. Maybe you are paid, or maybe you ask it to ask this question. And of course, it's a very strange way to govern your country, and that's why we ended up where we ended. But unfortunately, he still believes that these people are the most loyal. Probably he understood now they could be corrupt, but he still believes they are the only people he could trust.
So I want to read a few sentences from your book that talk exactly about this mentality that is so pervasive in the Russian state, under Putin specifically. In your new edition, you had a chapter looking at the Russian interference in the U.S. elections in 2016. And in that last chapter, you write, "Putin doesn't believe in mankind, nor does he believe in a benign society. The concept that people could voluntarily come together to do something for the common good. Those who try to do something, in this view, not directed by the government, were either spies, paid agents of foreign hostile forces, or corrupt. In other words, paid agents of corporations." And then you say that political or civic activity is seen as a dirty business by definition, and nobody could be trusted, and that was the main message. And this cynicism was Putin's gift to America. So I thought this was a really profound statement, where you describe this very paranoid, suspicious mentality of the Russian government today, that first and foremost targets and victimizes its own population by surveilling the population, by repressing independent media, forcing journalists like yourself and Narina to constantly be changing jobs. I think at this point, these stories are unfortunately very common, where we hear about journalists either being murdered or harassed or in other ways hurt in Russia today. By this jump that you make in this passage I read to the United States, can you talk a little bit about that? The cynicism was Putin's gift to America. What do you mean by that?
I mean that he tried this concept to be honest, very effectively in Russia, because we still live in a very confused post-Soviet, post-totalitarian society. And basically it means that we do not have any trust in institutions. It's a very widespread thing that for ordinary Russians to believe that, media matter, freedom of expression matter, or they believe in the parliament. That's not the case. Nobody actually trusts them. And Putin tried to undermine the credibility of these institutions for years. Actually, even his parliament was a joke, and it was accepted by the Kremlin that people would see his parliament as a joke. Because the idea was to have, if you have this image of the Russian society, Putin would love us to see it this way, that you have the population and a strong leader, nothing in between. And that makes him almost inevitable, because when you speak to ordinary Russians, the usual question you face if you say something about corruptness or the way things run by Putin, the usual question is, who else? We have only Putin. There is no one. All the rest are just corrupt, or they're too small or too greedy. So at least we know this guy. Mm-hmm. And I think to this extent, his concept was really, really effective. In the United States, I think his first idea was to try this not in the United States, but in Ukraine.
Yes.
And it was really effective because, well, for obvious reasons. Ukraine is also a post-totalitarian and very confused society with many problems, and we share the same background, we speak almost the same language, lots of people understand Russian, can speak Russian. We all have this legacy of the Second World War, which means a lot to lots of people, because almost every family lost someone during the war, which means some arguments used by Russian propaganda, like accusation of fascism, very emotional and very strong.
Right, this has really become the meta narrative of Russian state media today.
Absolutely.
To tie any enemy of the state, as whoever that may be in the particular moment, as a fascist, a Nazi, and all of these things. And we saw this very, very clearly with Ukraine, as you're saying.
Yeah. But it was also based on the idea of mistrust.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot trust Yanukovych, that's fine, but you cannot trust these revolutionaries, because they should be corrupt, just because they are, because we try to do something in public sphere. We should be corrupt, we should be paid by someone. We do not trust them. So that was the concept Putin then tried to export to the United States. But you already have some problems of trust here, and with the media, with many institutions. So he didn't actually invent this narrative, but he tried to exploit what you already have, and to some extent, it was quite effective.
So how exactly did that happen? You say, you know, Putin, and I think it's interesting that you say Putin and not the Russian state or the Kremlin. So I guess two questions for you: is it really Putin who's the puppet master behind, whether that be Russia disinformation campaigns in Ukraine or in Germany or in the United States, the hacking and the email theft that we saw in the United States, all of these seemingly coordinated attacks on Western institutions to make people doubt the legitimacy of those institutions, to make people trust those institutions less. Is Putin really the puppet master behind all of this? Or, I mean, I guess I'm trying to get a sense of, is the Russian state really that well coordinated under the czar, one could say?
What we need to understand here is what you described right now and listed looks like for the Western audience, it looks like a list of offensive operations. But for people inside of Russia, it looks absolutely different. The Kremlin really believe that they are on defensive. They believe that they are under constant attack, and that actually explains why Putin was personally involved in many of these stories. Ukraine was seen by Putin as a personal attack on him and on political stability of his enemy.
Meaning Ukraine's desire to join the EU eventually and sign the free trade agreement.
It was seen
in
as an offensive operation by the West with the goal to undermine his influence and finally to undermine the political stability in his country. Panama Papers expose was seen as a direct attack on him and his personal friends, and he needed to fight back. So many of these things were seen as a direct attack on him. And some things you just cannot do, without Putin, especially the United States. It's a very emotional topic for him from the very beginning. And just remember that when he became the president, he tried to please George W. Bush for some years. He was the very first foreign leader to make a call after 9/11. He gave up some military facilities in Cuba and Vietnam to please the United States because he wanted to be treated as equal, he wanted to be respected. And the moment he understood or he decided that he was betrayed, that triggered his emotional reaction. All these old conspiracy theories, all these old paranoia, just immediately he felt that finally he had a proof. It was true. They are always plotting against me. And that since then, it's a very personal and very emotional for him.
So what you're basically outlining is this notion that, you know, Putin's view of the international order is a West that is constantly trying to undermine Russia's interests, that is, you know, starting revolutions in Ukraine, the Arab Spring, the Middle East, and eventually this is something that the West will try to do in Moscow. Is that really the main fear?
Absolutely. And what we need to understand that in Russia, the picture is a bit, well, maybe primitive, maybe too simple, but we're always talking about, not about, say, Germany and Russia, not about UK and Russia, we are talking about the West and Russia. We are talking about the whole of the West and Russia because it's, first of all, it's good for the Russians to think, well, actually we present our Russian civilization, so that make us almost equal with the Western civilization, but it also make easier if you want to find proofs what the Western countries plotting against Russia. You always, well, out of all this big conglomerate of the countries, you can't find some proofs and feel into the Russian propaganda and say, look, just another proof, another sign of a big conspiracy against us.
And so you said that everything that Russia has done, this election meddling, interference through disinformation, other forms of interference in other countries' affairs, is a revenge war, basically, from Putin's point of view.
Yeah, it's a kind of retaliation, and that makes it so difficult to understand the Russian foreign policy because it's always reactive. They sort of react to things. Always in the same manner, but still they react. And sometimes their reaction might be brilliant in terms of tactics. Sometimes it's awful, like it was really crazy to invest, actually, to spend $50 billion on Sochi Olympic Games and destroy everything, actually, next week, interfering into Maidan and into Ukraine. But still, it's very reactive.
So from that point of view, the Russian interference in the U.S. elections, what was that revenge for? What was that a reaction to?
It was revenge and reaction on Panama Papers expose. It was quite clear, and we tried to trace what triggered this reaction. And finally, we came to this moment in the early April when journalists working on Panama Papers sent their request to the Kremlin asking for comments. And that triggered a very emotional reaction. Immediately we got some statements. Actually, this investigation was commented by the Kremlin even before the publication of Panama Papers, which is a very unusual way for the Kremlin to comment on these stories, because the usual way for the Kremlin is just never to comment on this, to let the story die. In this case, it was very, you might see, it was really, really personal. Putin personally commented on this story. He felt that he needed to defend his friend.
So for Putin, the Panama paper leak and the expose that followed was not something that was done by a network of independent journalists. It was really a Western ploy to try to take down him and those close to him.
Not just Western plot, but Hillary Clinton's plot. There was some strange miscalculation, and I think it was a kind of intelligence failure from the Russian side. But it looks like Putin was briefed about Podesta emails by the beginning of April.
April 2016.
And because the hackers were in the system of Podesta on March 18. So the thing is, what happened next, that a very strange conspiracy plot was construed with Goldman Sachs, Hillary Clinton's people, and journalists working on Panama Papers. So in Putin's mind, it was all part of this big conspiracy against him. And because he believed that Hillary Clinton was personally involved, well, he believed that now he is a kind of justified to fight back.
So a lot of information has been coming out recently about the extent and the breadth of Russian interference in the U.S. elections. I mentioned at the beginning that recently Google and Twitter and Facebook have all been asked and forced to come testify in front of the U.S. Congress. And some of the numbers they reveal in their testimonies, I think are quite shocking. And I don't know if it's really the full extent of it. Facebook said that 126 million individuals likely saw the ads and content that was put out by this the International Research Agency, is that what it's called?
That's right.
The so-called troll factory in Russia, and that this was a targeted set of campaigns on some specific U.S. states, but also targeted across users on Facebook. I think this is a really shocking figure, and that about $100,000 was spent specifically to promote certain ads that had divisive content about race or sexual orientation, LGBTQ rights, etc. For Twitter, they estimated that almost 3,000 of their accounts were these fake, inauthentic accounts, also linked to the troll factory in Russia. And similarly for Google, I mean, they have also come up with numbers about thousands of videos being posted on YouTube. Of course, that's owned by Google, again, linked to the same troll factory. So I think as all this information is coming out, I guess my question to you again is, you know, is this really being coordinated not by the Kremlin and by Putin himself? If this is really a personal revenge plot that he's carrying out against the United States and perhaps against Hillary Clinton specifically, or is this kind of an uncoordinated entrepreneurial attempt by various proxy organizations that are acting on behalf of the Kremlin, but not necessarily at the full direction of Putin himself? Which one is it?
Well, the problem is that these proxies, this Internet Research Agency, and their founder, actually happens to be in very personal relations with Vladimir Putin. So I think that actually, given the fact that these proxies were acting out of any Russian bureaucracy, not at the level of, and they contact with the government, not at the level of, federal agencies or the ministries, but they have their contacts at the level of the administration of the president. So my guess is that it would be absolutely impossible to do this kind of effort without a sanction from the very top. It's just impossible.
Well, I guess the investigation in the United States will keep going, and we'll get more information about that. But, you know, I want to, before we sign off, bring up two more things I want to get your thoughts on. One that you write about extensively in your book as well is, of course, Edward Snowden. I think the attention to the U.S. attempt to surveil the population really started with the Snowden leaks. Of course, Snowden is now living in Russia, where he went and sought asylum. And he's been there for a few years now. So what kind of figure is Snowden now in Russian politics? You know, what does he do in Russia today? You know, does he interact with people? You know, what is he doing?
He's a sort of ghost.
A ghost?
Yeah, it looks like he is there, but because he is banned from talking to Russian journalist or Moscow-based foreign journalist, and he speaks only to journalists coming specifically to interview him, so they are all approved in advance. So he is almost nowhere. Nobody can talk to him. Nobody's seen him. It looks like a kind of strategy to be seen that just out of the United States. I'm not in the United States. I'm not in Russia specifically, I'm just somewhere. And while he tried to face, actually to counter some of the criticisms, and he became a bit more critical of the Russian way to control the internet recently, which is a good thing. But unfortunately, he still... I mean, the most sensitive thing about him in Russia is how his revelations were used and exploited by the Russian government, promoting some crazy ideas about offensive on internet freedoms. For example, we got this data localization law forcing global platforms to move their servers into Russia under pretext of protecting Russian personal data from, say, NSA spying. So they obviously they exploited Snowden revelations. They even wanted to invite him to the Russian parliament to testify. Finally, it never happened, but still they used his revelations. The problem is that Snowden never tried to comment on this. He never tried to comment on how his revelations were used by the Russian authorities. Mm-hmm. So he's in a very strange situation and a kind of limbo. He's not part of the Russian political landscape. He's still there. And nobody knows what might happen to him. And his latest attempt to get out was actually last year. And he actually, as far as I understand, his people, they actually hoped that this Oliver Stone movie could help him to get, something out of Obama, his last days in the White House, but instead... Chelsea Manning was pardoned and released. So
he was hoping for a pardon from Obama because of the film Oliver Stone, the sort of, you could say, vindicated some of what he did.
Yes, actually, that was his hope, and they tried to launch some campaign here in the United States, and with calls to Obama to do something good in his last days in the White House. It never happened. Mm-hmm. So I think now he's in a limbo. And to be honest, I still... feel pretty sorry for him because I think he's a kind of idealist who put himself in absolutely impossible situation.
So you think that he actually had good intentions? There's many people that still suspect that he was a Russian spy from the very beginning.
No, I don't believe in it. I don't think so.
But now he's being used in this very interesting way by the Russian state to justify increasingly more repressive information laws. Because they're holding up Snowden and the revelations about NSA spying as this sort of, look at the United States and what they're doing. We have to protect ourselves. We have to clamp down on information. So in a way, he's become a bit of a useful idiot, wouldn't you say?
It looks like he tried to resist. He never appeared on, say, Russia Today, RT, or Sputnik. He was never used directly by the Russian propaganda. And of course, we would love to. So he put some restraints. He said, I think he said no in some cases. But of course, he's trapped in this situation. Mm. And given the fact that you live surrounded by these people with almost no option to get out, well, it's tough.
So I think lastly, you know, the big question, I think, for most people in the United States is, you know, where is this all going? You know, Russia has, I think, taken this very risky step to strategically interfere with what you say direction from the very top, from Putin himself, in the U.S. presidential elections. Now there's lots of fears about this happening again, and maybe Russia not being the main actor, maybe China or Iran, any other state being able to use the same set of tools. Where do you think this is all headed? I mean, are we going to be living in a world in the very near future where there really isn't a way to protect democratic processes anymore, where we should actually just expect interference from foreign governments like Russia and others, that this whole era of integrity in elections is pretty much over?
We, in a way, are stuck in this old Cold War scheme. We still think that if, say, during the Cold War we had how many nuclear powers? 5, 7. We still believe that in the new age of cyber warfare, it should be about these countries. The problem is that lots of cyber experts told me that these days, to get to this level of cyber capabilities, even for the countries with very bad economy, it needs only 5 years, mm-hmm. which means that lots of countries could be provoked to think that actually we can do a lot with very limited risks for them. And of course, it's a very frightening picture for me, also because only now we are getting to the stage that to the moment that these information operations, and because we are talking not about cyber operations, we are talking about information operation.
That's right.
And even if we are talking about hacking, it's not hacking into some critical systems. We are talking about email accounts. The problem is that what might happen if we get to the moment when these things would be combined? I mean, the real attack on something real in critical infrastructure of the country, combine it with an information operation. That would be really, really something. And I think that's what's coming next. And it could be really terrifying, unfortunately.
It's certainly a bleak picture. And I guess the main hope is, at least in the United States, now there's so much attention on these issues that, you know, we're going to take this more seriously going forward. At least that's the hope. You know, Andre, just before I let you go, I just want to thank you not just for coming here and talking to us, but for doing the work that you do in Russia. I don't think that's easy. I think you're in a very difficult situation. But, you know, thank you for doing the work that you do, for taking the risks that you probably have to take to continue to provide us with good journalism and good information about a topic that we don't know very much about. In the United States or elsewhere in the West. So
thanks you.
Again. It's a pleasure having
you. Thank you,
Elena. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to my colleague Elena for taking over the podcast and making me not have to deal with any of it. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only, the right, the honorable Sophia Yan. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. So come on, if you haven't tweeted us yet and told the world how much you love us, and if you haven't left us that rating on the iTunes store, get on it, because we need your help. We don't advertise. We don't do any of the things to promote the podcast. We only have you guys. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.